So you lead 60 laps in arguably your best ever IndyCar weekend, and you still lose to Alex Palou. Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
Dre, I've got to tell you, this is just really lazy recycling of the whole death taxes Penske thing.
In this case, it's now death taxes and apparently Chip Ganassi's number 10. Who would have thought it? Hey, he even got a bonus prize. We've got two on the podium this time round too. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 650 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friend and neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Glad you could join us. And we're back to something like a regular, normal schedule again after...
Woo.
A month of conflict in the Middle East, delaying everything in major motorsport until now. We're back. Hello, everybody. Good to see you. Hope you're having a good time as ever, and hope everybody's staying safe as always, too. So, a lot to get through from, well, I guess we could say IndyCar's weekend at Long Beach, but it wasn't just IndyCar, because we also had a certain someone that was there for the IMSA race as well. Isn't that right, Mr. Rory James O'Connell?
Yeah, that's me. You full name here. well, I'm back. Really happy that I went. For those of you who know, I was going to go to Long Beach last year. The novel coronavirus finally got to me after 5 years of just being able to duck, dodge, dive, dip, and dodge it. And then it got me, and I missed it last year. But this year, I was able to go. And I got to tell you, what everybody says about the event as a whole, I get it now. That was so much fun. Just the vibrance of the city during all the events and just the totality of the event itself, because obviously IndyCar is the main event, but it's more than that. You had IMSA this weekend. You had Stadium Super Trucks. Yes, they still exist. Did you know that Robbie Gordon and his son Max are currently dominating the series at this point in time? With Robbie, yeah. It makes sense, but Max is just like, wait a second. Max Gordon is like still a teenager at this stage. He made his Stadium Super Trucks debut before he could get a learner's permit in the United States. That's how crazy this shit is. We had historic racing, which was all like old IMSA GTO and Trans Am cars, which looked beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Formula Drift had an exhibition event with numerous cars, including a certain purple BMW. With a certain sponsor or even a combination of sponsors that may be very familiar in the household of our guest, Christopher DeHardy.
Oh, what sponsor was this?
Well, one of them is Penthouse Magazine, which is not new to the world of racing. In fact, I remember Playboy and Penthouse have sponsored many cars down the years. The other is a certain kind of... tool men use. It sounds like flashlight, but is not flashlight. And yes, Formula Drift will let that company be a sponsor of a car that competes in the top tier of its U.S. championship. I love Drift. It's so much fun. I love Long Beach. It was so much fun. I had a great time, but I'm back to be home. Glad to be back home, at least for another week before I got to turn around and go right back to Laguna Seca.
Welcome, Chris. Good to see you. You got the warmest welcome you've ever had on this podcast. Congratulations.
I know, right? I wonder what the exclusivity clause would be in that championship where it's like, okay, you can't have that as a sponsor. Like, what would the series, the title sponsor have to be? RJ, I'm glad you got to experience Long Beach. It's been since 2022 was the last time I was able to actually go to that event. It's very, very great to go to. You're able to walk around a lot of different places, a lot of different restaurants to go to. And if you plan well enough with your accommodations, you don't have to rent a car at all, which really helps save on travel costs.
That's right. I was fortunate enough to be staying in a place that's like 10-minute walk from the track. And on the way to the walk is one of the best coffee shops in downtown Long Beach. Recreational coffee. This is not a plug. I just really like their stuff the 2 days that I visited. Yeah, it's open. It's accessible. The people there are great. Like, I like Detroit as an event. Sometimes people give Detroit a bad rap, whether it's a city, the racetrack, whatever. I enjoyed going there last year, but there's levels to this, man. It's Long Beach. They've been doing this for 50 years. And I know Jim McAlean, who put on this event for over half a century, is no longer here. God rest his soul. But I certainly felt that all the good work he's doing is going to continue for another half century. Hopefully, the product of the main event race will not will continue to go up and up, which we'll talk about later.
I will say about Jim McCallion, other podcasts have had him as a guest. If one wants to listen to a fantastic interview with him, Trackside with Kurt Cavan and Kevin Lee had him on in April of 2025. I think it was the April 2nd episode, if my memory is correct. If you truly enjoy good content in motorsports, do yourself a favor and check that interview out. Very, very engaging. And, you know, as people get older, you worry about whether or not they're going to be sharp between the ears and everything like that. Jim was fully lucid. He was with it. Yeah. He remembered everything. And as a lot of people get older, that's a very much a worry with, you know, people as they age. But he was there with it. He was sharp. And that's a blessing for a lot of people at that age. So, you know, my hat's off to him. Hats off to George Barber. He was so great for that race that we had a few weeks ago.
100%.
Two titans of the IndyCar community that are no longer with us. They're on the great racetrack in the sky.
Absolutely, man. Couldn't have said it better myself, Chris. And Dre, what do we got to talk about on this fine episode of Motorsport 101?
A lot. This is a surprisingly loaded IndyCar episode on this occasion, actually. We'll talk a little bit about IMSA's race there, because that's what RJ was actually here for. He snuck back into the IndyCar race as a stowaway on Sunday.
It's true. It's true. I'm there. Look, I'm there. And when they check your credentials on Sunday, it does not say that IMSA hard card holders have to fuck off, because Porsche Carrera Cup North America and IMSA Shanks and Sports Series also ran on the Sunday before the main event. But yes, we got IndyCar, we got IMSA.
So in other words, you snuck in on Sunday on a technicality. Is that what you're basically telling me?
It's no technicality. It's no technicality if you're meant to be there.
Right. Anyway, we'll talk a little bit about IMSA.
To be fair to RJ, he did the same thing in Detroit last year, but the event staff in Detroit... The event staff in Detroit are very, very nice. The event staff in Detroit are very nice. He said, come on in.
So, I love that you just outed your friend here by technically stretching the levels of his media credentials just a touch on the occasion there.
Ticket is still
a very small amount of payback I'm able to get.
Can I get through the intro while you enjoy your fleshlight? Thank you. Now, what else on this show also includes, we've also got IMSA, we'll talk about that, and of course we'll talk about IndyCar's race itself, the new qualifying format change that's now been made permanent after a trial in Arlington, but not quite the same as how Arlington had it. We'll talk about some of the changes there. We'll talk about the race itself, as Felix Rosenquist led 60 laps of the race until he very suddenly didn't again. And we'll talk about the rest of the race. We'll talk about him. We'll talk about the tires. We'll talk about a weird push-to-pass story that broke out on Monday morning as well, which was very strangely worded and has gone down like a lead balloon, because we can't have an IndyCar weekend without some degree of drama, whether it be on or off the track. All of that and more in the next hour or so. We'll do the social media at the end because I can't be bothered right now. So let's talk a little bit about IMSA. RJ, that's what you were there for. It's kind of a bittersweet end to that weekend, in a sense, if you were there just for the IMSA action, because on the one hand, Acura wins. On the other side, well, I'll let you break the news.
Right. This just came down the pipeline Wednesday, but you got to roll back to Friday. Although I knew that something was in the works going into Friday, even before I got to Long Beach. Friday, Racer.com reported that Acura was considering its future in IMSA after the 2026 season due to a variety of reasons. It's a challenging global automotive market, for one. Honda has had to cut off a number of its future EV projects that it was going to come out with. On the other, Honda Racing Corporation wanted more budget to incorporate all the activities that it's doing now and all the activities it's going to do, like the new IndyCar engine program, a third Meyershank Racing entry, which will effectively be a manufacturer charter entry, and keep all the stuff that it's currently doing, like revitalizing the F1 effort, revitalizing the MotoGP effort, etc. But there was no budget increase, and so a decision had to be made, and that decision came down Wednesday that Acura will be pausing its GTP program after the 2026 season, which means that the two-car Acura Meyershank Racing program, as we know it, will be no more after the season ends. And it's bittersweet because Renger van der Zande and Nick Bjelleley in the number 93 car, which is co-engineered by Honda Racing Corporation itself, won the race. And it was a big deal for them because since the unification of IMSA from American Le Mans Series and Grand Am, Acura hadn't won the sports car main event at Long Beach, and they did. And then just days later, this announcement comes down, which really is a shame because on the one hand, I know people were hoping to see the ARS06 compete at Le Mans. And unless an intrepid privateer wants to bring it to the World Endurance Championship, which there have been rumors about as late as January that ultimately fell through, it looks unlikely to happen. The door is still ajar for a privateer to take over the program. The door is still ajar for Acura to come back because we are getting a new prototype regulation set in 2030 that looks to be a sensible evolution of what we have now, where we do a second step of convergence into one platform instead of trying to balance out two. So Acura still has the option to come back, but when it comes back, I don't think it's going to be like what we had. And it's a shame because Acura, going back to the DPI days, won three championships. They've won every major enduro on the IMSA calendar. Daytona twice, Sebring, Watkins Glen, Petit Le Mans, this program in a short period of time. Let's not forget, despite the controversy that would come out like a month afterwards, Acura opened the new IMSA GTP era with a 1-2 finish. So no matter what, you could say that if the first place car was not legal, then the second place car, to our knowledge, has never been found of any wrongdoing. So Acura would have won either way. They were second in the champion, the manufacturer standings last year. It is a bummer to see them go. It's a bummer that it feels like the Platinum Age is only going to be depreciating down to gold. Remember, we're still in a much better place than we are when DPI was in its final years or when LMP1 exploded. But man, it is going to suck to lose Acura because of, you know, we got a number of Honda fans that listen to the show. I like seeing Honda perform at this high level. I've liked the program. I've gotten along well with the drivers and some of the people that work behind the scenes, whether it's PR or even up at the very top. David Salters was one of the most entertaining chats I had over the offseason when I sat down for coffee with him in November at Daytona Beach. So it sucks. Hopefully they get to come back when a new regulation set comes in the pipeline. But yeah, it was very weird covering that Long Beach weekend, knowing that that was probably their one chance to win Long Beach, knowing how badly they wanted it.
Yeah, that's it's not an ideal circumstance there. I mean, it's nice that they won at Long Beach, but it's not so nice when you know in the back of your head that this might be their last crack and you knew that something was coming. I mean, the wording they used was pausing their program, which I think is significant when it comes to how they handled it and spoke to the media. It's not the end. It's goodbye for now by the sounds of it. Hopefully they'll be back in 2030. Again, as you mentioned, there's still a possibility that customers might take on at least
you gotta have the money to like underwrite all the program with no true factory support, because if you're a privateer taking on that project, you are not going to be running things the way MSR is running it.
No, and MSR are a good organization.
Crazy enough that we're getting this. Think back to last year when it seemed like Honda was just running down the clock until the last possible moment to tell IndyCar that they're leaving to do all the other stuff that they're doing now, plus Formula One. Now, flip side, a year later, IMSA's gone, and Acura is going to have its sticker on more cars in the IndyCar series after Honda has renewed their engine agreement.
I think we should also note,
just quickly,
I think we should also note one thing here real quick. On the Meyer-Shank Racing statement about Acura's news today, they said that they were open to continuing its presence in IMSA competition with other OEM partners. Last I remember checking, I think Ford is doing a GTP car.
That's right. But they don't have a working relationship.
They won the Rolex 24 together.
You're right there. And the thing is, if Acura is not going to be competing at IMSA for the foreseeable future and Ford doesn't have an IMSA customer yet, that could be something to work on. The question is, I know they're not going to be the only entity that's going to be bidding for that Ford contract and try and bring them into IMSA. Hello, Chip.
There's going to be discussions on that, no doubt about it. Just a quick reading of the full statement from MSR that came out earlier today. It says, quote, "We are incredibly thankful for our partnership with Honda, Acura, and HRC, and the success we've shared together in IMSA competition. Their support and commitment have played a key role in the growth of our program and the accomplishments we've achieved as a team. As we look to the future, we're excited to expand our relationship with Acura into the NTT IndyCar Series, beginning with the Indianapolis 500 this May on the number 66 Honda." That's Marcus Armstrong's car. "At the same time, Mayer Shank Racing remains open to continuing its presence in IMSA competition and exploring opportunities with other OEM partners." So yeah, expect to see some more Acura branding on Marcus Armstrong's car across the month of May. Right around the corner. So that's something at least. Thank God Cameron Buckley's not on this episode. Otherwise, he'd have pissed many, many pints of blood about Porsche being hit with a 45 kilo BOP adjustment.
Oh, no. His steak is so buttery that the 45 kilogram battles of performance only left them able to extract a painful
third
and fourth place with their two factory cars.
Survive.
I never want to hear that man complain about shit ever again. I love you, buddy, but you ain't complaining about shit the rest of this year. Can I tell you what else I loved? Robert Wickens' drive in the GTD class, because this was his first race back in 8 months. Second year driving the sprints for DXDT Racing, the Corvette. He won pole position after one of the Vassar Sullivan Lexuses got kicked out of pole for a technical infringement after qualifying. Their car was legal before tech. It wasn't legal after. Funny how these things happen. Wickens drove superbly, of course. I just feel bad for his co-driver, Mason Filippi, who was put in a tough spot coming out of a full course yellow to drive most of the race when Wickens was the quicker driver. But the way the strategy dictates, and because we know Robert Wickens has a spinal cord injury, generally speaking, it is easier for Wickens to start the race and the other driver to take in after Wickens is pulled out of the car instead of trying to put him in the car, right?
Yeah, I believe he said it's about 4 seconds extra in the pit stop to make that switch happen, basically.
Yeah, and that's to pull him out of the car with assistance. Let alone, we don't know what it's like to try and strap him into the car with assistance, but he covered that delta. But they were coming out of a full course yellow. Filippi gets held up in traffic, loses the lead. And then the next lap gets shoved in the wall by Robbie Foley's Turner BMW, which then allows him to get freight trained by Foley and three other cars. And DXDT Racing doesn't even finish on the podium, which is a bummer. But I was kind of glad to see Vassar Sullivan get a win with the old Lexus RCF. And the symmetry that provides, because 30 years ago at Long Beach, Jimmy Vassar won the Grand Prix of Long Beach for the first time, driving car number 12 for Chip Ganassi. What was the winning car number in GTD? The number 12 Lexus.
Yep, the Lexus is in Grand Unc division, and it still finds a way to win.
And also, one more thing. Benjamin Peterson is an IMSA race winner. He's got more wins at Long Beach than Santino Ferrucci. What a time to be alive.
It's something. We'll take it. That's still the fastest rookie in the history of the Indy 500. It's worth something. Okay? We got to give him that. We do have to hand it to him. So there you go. That's a quick chat about IMSA at Long Beach. Right after this, we'll talk about IndyCar's quite wild weekend at Long Beach. So, with IndyCar, we have to pause to talk about Saturday first. We don't normally do that on this show, but this is a special occasion. Again, like Arlington, twice in 3 episodes, what can you say? IndyCar announced a permanent change to its road and street qualifier. We talked about this a little bit last week, but here's now the full details about what's happening. Taking up most of the one-shot qualifying format they trialed in Arlington, here's the key changes. So now, in IndyCar qualifying, this is going to be for all road and street courses going forwards. the top six in round two not only go through to the far six round, they now determine the draft order. So think of like a draft. Whoever qualifies fastest in round two now gets first choice of when they get to set their hot lap in the fast six session. It goes in order. So fastest qualifier in round two gets to pick first, then whoever qualified second, third, etc., down to sixth. Funnily enough, in this instance, David Malukas, who was the fastest qualifier in round two, got to pick. It was exactly the same running order as we got in round two as in terms of qualifying speed, except for Pato O'Ward. This is apparently only going to be on street circuits. So
yeah, got the release right here. Yeah.
It's not going to be one shot on road courses. My apologies. But yes, so the order was exactly the same, except for Pato O'Ward, who picked fifth. He chose to go last to take advantage of track evolution. So Dixon, who qualified sixth, had to go in fifth. Also, on top of that, there's also a 10-minute break after round two. I think I know why that was put in place, but we'll get to that in a minute. Open choice of tires. Everybody kept the same ones they qualified in round two. And there is a mandated commercial break after the third run. So there is a tactical element of trying to get into the top three for reasons we'll get to in a minute. So with that in mind, Felix Rosenqvist, who was the third runner, ended up actually qualifying fastest. Alex Palou had a lockup on his hot lap. It cost him about a couple of attempts, and that's ultimately what made the difference, because it was Rosenqvist, Pato O'Ward second, taking advantage of going last, and Alex Palou, who ended up third ahead of his main title rival at the moment, Kyle Kirkwood. So now we've seen it in action. Now that we've seen it going forward, what did you guys make of the qualifying change to the fast six for street tracks now?
I'll tell you exactly what I thought. Welcome back to the old Super GT Series super lap format.
Oh, yeah.
Which was basically you run all your standard qualifying, and then at the very end, you send the top six or top eight cars or whatever it was at the time, and you do a super lap, which is basically the same concept of one-shot qualifying where all these top six cars get to fight for pole position. And I got to say, like, I think the changes, you know, actually, I'm in the agreement of like, I don't know yet. I don't know yet. I liked what I saw when I was observing Long Beach qualifying in the time that I had while I wasn't, you know, crunching through copy, because that was immediately after the IMSA race. But I got to say, I thought it was good and good for Felix Rosenqvist to get this pole position, continuing what turned out to be a pretty stellar day in a vacuum for Meyer-Shank Racing. They got the win just a few hours earlier.
And he got to high-five Trey Cool afterwards, so what's not to love?
Trey Cool was such a cool guest. I know. But it's great guest. You could do so, so much worse. And they have, when it comes to celebrity guests that they could shove into the fastest two-seater in racing.
Yeah, I'm still hoping for the day they send Pat McAfee around there just for my own entertainment.
With a neck brace on to keep up kayfabe.
Of course, kayfabe is what matters here. Tony Khan at the NFL draft, we're looking at you. Now, yeah, I think it's fine. I don't love it. As I've said before on this show, I was never the biggest reference is Formula One in the mid-2000s before they had the Q1-2-3 format. They had a couple of years of one-shot qualifying. I was never the biggest fan of it. I thought one-shot qualifying was kind of boring. One part of an F1 weekend that everybody objectively loves is qualifying. No one messes with the qualifying format because it just works. The three rounds, the elimination elements of it, the stampede of late laps at the end of a session, it just works. Right. And IndyCars inherited that for the most part. And for the first two rounds, it basically is that anyway. So that's fine. I think they've nearly got it here. Like, I think I can live with one shot qualifying. I think it's a little dull, but I think it's fine. I don't hate it by any stretch of the imagination. I think there's a couple of things they still need to tweak. Number one, I don't like the fact that there's a mandated commercial break in the middle. That just slows the pace down. I get why it's done. Take advantage of the situation. Get as many viewers as you can. Advertise, whatever. It's fine. I get it. It happens. Also, I think it's a little... If the problem is that the open tire choice, I think, is going to be a bit of a problematic issue here. And I say that because everybody that ran in that Fast 6 session stuck with the tires they had on in round two. One less heat cycle that's to put through the tire, it's going to warm up a little bit quicker. There is an inherent disadvantage in going fifth and sixth, but I think it's bigger than the advantage you get through track evolution. Pato Award maybe proved me wrong on that, because he went sixth in that session and he still qualified second. Sample size is a bit too small for me to really get into that right now, because this is only the second time we've done this. But the point is that, and this is something that Alex Rossi and James Hinchcliffe talked about on Reddit and on their own podcast, the Off-Track Pod, why Marcus Ericsson was so busted in Arlington was because they went to the final round straight away, and because we just finished round two, Marcus Ericsson's tires were still hot. So he had a huge advantage going first in the final round, while everybody else had to sit in the box and wait while their tires were cooling down. I think you give everybody an extra set of sticker reds and balance the books entirely.
That's exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think if you did that, you eliminate the unfair advantage, because why would you want to tune into a 20-minute Fast 6 session where the guy that's going first has a huge advantage? It's bad for TV. Because that's exactly what happened in Arlington. Ericsson was busted and no one else came close.
Right. And to the point about, you know, fresh tires for the Fast 6 session, like, do that for the road courses too, because, like, I would like to see on the road courses where you do have the traditional 6-minute format, them being able to push on a fresh set of tires for pole position.
Yeah, I'll go one further. Go on.
I'll go one further. IndyCar does not allow tire warmers in the series. Why not have Firestone provide the set of sticker reds for the Firestone Fast 6, but have them actually heated up in tire ovens like you see in WEC? Only used for the Fast 6 qualifiers. You make it to the Fast 6, you get a reward with a fresh set of hot, sticky red sidewall tires ready to go.
He's kind of cooking here.
Yeah, let's incentivize making the Fast 6, and then you can make it easy. You just go in reverse order. Because let's keep this simple. If you qualified first in round two, you go last in the last session. Because if everyone's on the same tires, then the advantage goes towards the back of the running order, because that means there's the most rubber on track if you're the number six guy. Like, I think IndyCar has overcomplicated this just a little bit. They're nearly there. And I think the only issue I've really got is the tires and the commercial break after three runs. I get why the commercial break is there. I don't hate it. Again, I know it's a necessary evil of being a TV product. But the only other issue I've got, and I'm going to be a filthy, selfish Brit for just a second here, because I did not find this out until the weekend itself. The US broadcast gets sector timing splits on these hot laps. Us international feed enjoyers don't.
Yeah, this is the one. This is one of the few things that's great about America. Our production quality is better. Yeah, everything else sucks, but this is fine.
Again, I get it. We can't have commercials, so we can't just take the Fox feed whenever it's shown on Sky Sports F1 here in the UK. But there's no reason why we can't have sector splits for everybody. There's no good reason why we can't do that.
Yeah.
And that stinks. Like, I get it. The international feed is not as high a priority for obvious reasons. It's a national series where 95% of its global viewers are going to be in North America. I understand that. I get that. I'm not acting like I'm being an entitled crybaby here. But from a production standpoint, there is, as far as I'm aware, no good reason why we can't have split times.
Yeah.
None.
And how long have we been talking about, like, the gaps in quality on these IndyCar broadcasts?
A lot. Fox,
multiple broadcasters.
Yeah, Fox in the IMS production truck has not got along well this year. This was probably the best one they've had so far this season, but there were still issues, and this is one that I think is an issue. If you're going to have this format, which I'm largely fine with, give the people the basic information to deduce who's ahead and who isn't. Like, don't get me wrong, Will Buxton did a pretty decent job having to fill that in through the splits as they got him in the booth. But it's going to be inconsistent because they're human. It's not a computer. You don't have to rely on that. And if we could see what's happening through the splits rather than just the basic red or green, if you're ahead or in behind, that's not enough information. You know, being informed is important with things like this. And I feel like it's something that is, it's an easy fix that I don't think is something that's held back by region of viewer. So, yeah, I think for me, that's how I look at the whole format. I went on there. Though. Chris, tell me, how do you feel about it?
We could put a human being on this near the surface of the moon. We could figure this out. We've got the technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's not rocket science.
It's not rocket science. Indeed. But no, overall, I think it's fine with a little bit of room for improvement. I think, again, give everybody an extra set of tires if they make the Fast Six and force them to use it, and I think you're fine. Oh, the thing a little bit annoying is we now have three different qualifying formats for all three disciplines in IndyCar, which is a little bit weird.
Four.
That's right. Because the Indy 500 is not like all the other ovals. It's bigger. It's faster. It's 110 years old this May. Christ. So then we go to the race itself, and Felix Rosenqvist ran this show. Felix Rosenqvist led the first 58 laps. He was in control for the first two-thirds of the race. And Alex Palou was hovering around podium contention, but relatively speaking, he was struggling to stay with Rosenqvist after getting past Pato O'Ward early in the race for second place. But then came the key flashpoint. It was a debris caution, the first of any kind at Long Beach in over a year. That forced the entire field into their final routine pit stops, because it was either going to be a two or three stop race. This was the second or the third, if you're Joseph Newgarden. We'll talk about that later. Felix Rosenqvist did not have a bad pit stop. The problem was Alex Palou's perfect 10s were better. They won the race off of pit road, and then Palou, once they went back to green, pulled away from the field as if he had just been toying with us for the first two-thirds of the race. He took control on the primary tire to take his 22nd career IndyCar win and his first at Long Beach. I'd say he's completed the IndyCar series, and with it, of course, he took a 17-point lead in the championship. Man, Kyle Kirkwood leading the standings was good for that 1 week.
It was fun. I mean, I think Buxton said on the broadcast, Alex Palou has now won every road and street course he's visited in IndyCar, except for Arlington, where he was second in his one attempt they've had so far, losing to an inhuman stint from Kyle Kirkwood at the end, and Toronto, where he finished second with a broken wing to Christian Lingard that one time. Given that most people will tell you that Long Beach is the second most prestigious IndyCar race on the calendar to win if it's not the 500, you could tell it meant a lot to Palou, and it was a big deal. Only 16 drivers have ever won the 500 and the Grand Prix of Long Beach as a doubleheader. It's a pretty unique club, and Palou is its latest member, and yeah. Like, as Vic points out in the chat, because stats are always fun, average finish of 4.8 so far this season, and that's with the 24th in Phoenix included.
The race that he didn't finish, because nobody's perfect, it seems. But in this last in the race, I mean, Palou was. And once again, we are reheating discussions about Palou's dominance is killing the sport. it's not really Long Beach drew its biggest domestic TV rating in a hot minute. They need to get to a new car. They do, because then that'll put Alex Palou back in its place. He won't. He's a damn good driver and one of the most adaptable that I've seen in recent memory.
Well, no doubt in my mind about that. We saw him in prototypes. He's been an excellent prototype driver in the few appearances he's been able to make for them, whether it be with Cadillac or Acura. The man can drive, and it's I know it sounds like a broken record saying this, but you put that man in open air on primary tires, he's unbeatable at this point.
Which is exactly like, it's what happened again.
And it was all thanks to the left rear tire changer of Felix Rosenquist having a small wheel gun issue, according to Bozy Tatarevic on Twitter. It looks like there was a small wheel gun issue on the left rear tire that cost him 1.5 seconds, and that's what put Palou in clear air.
That's wild.
However, there is some good news from Wireshank Racing in all of this. All three drivers on the podium have driven for their IMSA GTP program.
That's right.
Take that away from it.
And can I extend this metaphor even further? Because Kakuno Shinota won his Super Taikyu race at Suzuka hours after Wireshank won. Like, this was a great day for Wireshank Racing, except for, you know, what was bubbling behind the scenes with the IMSA program. But otherwise, it was all going great. And I find it wild that they had that wheel gun issue, because 8.5 seconds is not a bad pit stop. A bad pit stop is just like the car completely stalls off the jacks. They can't get the tire on for several seconds. They can't get the fuel hose in. That didn't look like a bad stop.
Pit Road became the boulevard of broken dreams for Felix Rosenquist.
They were doing that all weekend, dog.
He was having the time of his life, you know?
Okay. But in all seriousness, dog.
For those of you who did not see the race, Green Day launched a SiriusXM channel on the day after the race, which was why their drummer was at Long Beach as well. Activation, folks. It's important in motorsports.
You're damn right.
No kidding. I mean, it's funny that the Hardy mentioned Bozy as well, because he's actually been ranking the pit crews in IndyCar so far this season. And funnily enough, Scott Dixon's pit crew is the best in IndyCar so far ranked, and Alex Palou's crew is the fourth best in the field, because Chip Ganassi stays winning, and he likes winners, and his pit crews have been outstanding so far this season. It wasn't... Like, an 8.5 second stop is not slow in IndyCar by any means. It's just that he lost 1.5 seconds to Alex, and that was enough for him to beat him out of pit lane by a third of a car. And that was a difference maker. And as RJ said, and I've said before, if you give Alex Palou the primary tire and open air, he will beat you. He is unstoppable on that combination. We saw it in St. Pete, and we saw it again here. I just feel bad for Felix, because it was the other way around for the first two-thirds of this race, and that deserves to be acknowledged. Palou struggled on the reds to stay with Rosenquist. He drifted off to about 3 seconds back by the time that debris caution came out. It was almost like Felix was beating Palou at his own game. Yeah. Now, I know that 10 team had openly said on the radio they were planning to go one lap longer, so Palou had to save extra fuel while also trying to maintain a decent gap back to Felix, just in case it happens. We never got that execution on the green, because we were just coming into that zone where we were going to talk about second stops, and then the debris caution comes out. Like I said, first caution we've had at Long Beach for like 160 racing laps, which is wild that we've even gotten there, that sort of streak. But that was... It's the second race weekend in a row where there's a flashpoint where Alex Palou is beatable, and it didn't quite work out. It was won and lost, arguably, in the pits after what happened in Barber with Christian Lingard as well. So it goes to show you that these little differences can make a big difference. I mean, those 2 second place to first place swings, that's 20 points minimum. Talking about how the scoring system works, that's a huge difference. And hey, Alex Palou now leads the championship by 17. So this stuff matters, man. It matters. And it goes to show you that Palou outside of Felix has been just virtually unstoppable this season. Go on, Chris.
As a friend of mine said, playing the role of Christian Lundgaard, Felix Rosenquist.
that was Felix's best weekend in IndyCar for me. I know he's won at Grand Prix before. I know he's run at Road America before, but this was Felix's weekend from top to bottom. Fastest qualifier. The speed's always been there with Felix. And amazingly, he hadn't had a top 10 going into this race all season. And he goes and pulls that out. He's so good on street tracks. The pace has always been there in qualifying, but it's never been able to quite come together in a race yet under MSR. And he nearly had it. It would have been MSR's first win in IndyCar for nearly 5 years.
That's right, because they still haven't won since Elio won his fourth Indy 500 back in 2021. It's been that long. And also that same year, hey, remember how Felix Rosenquist didn't initially set in well with McLaren and they spent 2 years trying to fire him?
Yeah. From someone they couldn't get rid of him straight away. It's why he married his longtime partner, Pato O'Ward. That's a joke, everybody, before anybody starts sending me more.
Hey, they did share the front row together.
It was like an old married couple going down the altar.
Hey, Dre, question. Had problems with the street course tire, the option tire, specifically the red side, the Firestone Wolfpack, as it were, for not being sturdy enough once they bolted on the hybrid in these cars. Have the tires gone too far the other way, you reckon?
It's a weird one because I thought the degradation was going to be bigger than what they actually were in it. Because obviously last year we saw a very different kind of race. We saw Joseph Newgarden ditch the green sidewall, the recyclable Firestone tire after two laps. It was a bold strategy to basically get rid of them. We saw that all through 2025 where the green tires were falling apart after a handful of laps. I said before that IndyCar is determined to try and get more action, especially on road and street courses, because I think they've noticed that the racing isn't quite as exciting as it's been on ovals for a little while now. And I fear they may have gone a bit too far the other way with these ones, because we hardly saw any tire degradation at all in this race. I had a third party live timing out while watching this race, and there was virtually no drop off in tire pace whatsoever. They were doing 110s at the start of the stint and they were doing 110s at the end of the stint. It just did not matter. There was no drop off at all. It became basically Scott Dixon's wet dream, a fuel mileage race. And I get it. You know, maybe they overcorrected a little bit compared to last year, but it's funny because Alex Rossi spoke about this to the media the other day, and it's kind of what we were talking about last year. These cars weren't built to have these hybrids put on them, and there's no getting around it. They are about 100 pounds heavier for those who are in the UK like me. That's about 45 kilos. It puts the Indy car at about 770 now, not including the driver. That's about 50 kilos more than what Formula One's horrible, terrible, super clipping, disastrous Formula One cars are weighing at the moment, depending on who you ask. So to put that into perspective, 770 kilo car, call it 850 once a driver's in there, call it 900 once you've got a full tank of fuel in it. Not a huge amount of power. 750 horsepower is still a lot, but it's not what Formula One's got, where it's got about 1,000 now.
It's not what IndyCars were making back in the glory days, the days that we all glaze from mine and Chris's childhoods.
Yeah.
Look, you're not that much older than me.
because they deserve to be glazed. Oh, take me back. But in all
10-4. And you also figured the aero screen with the weight, it's not just the fact that you've got the weight on the car, but where it is. It's high. It's the highest point you can get on the car. When you want weight in a race car, you want it low.
Absolutely.
And we're on version 2 of the aero screen, which is about 5 to 10 pounds higher than what the first generation was. So I'm hoping that when they have the new car in 2028, that the aero screen design is a lot more integrated. It's not going to be nearly as cumbersome, not nearly as outwardly extruding. I know back in the late 80s, the windscreens went up to almost the top of the driver's head, so you could barely see them. But then again, that was also the era where the driver's feet were way in the front of the car. And yeah, not good. But yeah, we still got another, 18 months before the new car makes its debut?
We're speculating on who the test drivers are going to be for the new car. And please, no more delays. That's all I can ask. Like, I am proud of the IR12, the DW12 or IR18 service, but, you know, it's been a good run, but it's time.
I've joked about it before. It's had an aero screen and supercapacitors attached to it. It's the Sega CD32X of racing cars in terms of trying to get it all onto one package and try to figure out a way of making it work. And the chinks in the armor have now started to come out in the last couple of years. This is a 14-year-old race car at this point. It's heavier than it's supposed to be. It's not in the right places. I've seen complaints about drivers talking about skidding tires, the dirty air that comes with that. It means it's really hard to pass people. It's a lot of what Formula One folks have been complaining about for some time. And I know this series loves to punch up at F1, but it's got the same deal of problems that make passing really difficult. I know, and this is Long Beach, which where passing is already at a premium as it is. So it's not the most ideal of combinations, so to speak. So I hope there's no more delays. We know we're 18 months away from the new car. Please let it all go through in one piece, because I hope we don't have to sit back here and talk about more delays and more trivial reasons as to why this hasn't happened yet, because the hybrids had a difficult birth in the first place. The last thing we need is more hiccups.
For sure. Dre, interesting story came out Monday morning after the race. Very interesting story came out after the race.
Okay, so this came out on Monday morning, and it was a very, shall we say, strange statement that the series came out. I'm just trying to scroll down on my timeline to find it right now. Give me just a second here.
You remember a couple of years ago, Push to Pass Gate, Button Ghazi, or whatever we were calling the Team Penske Push to Pass scandal, where primarily Joseph Newgarden, but also Scott McLaughlin, but primarily Joseph Newgarden, were caught using their Push to Pass button when they were not supposed to at St. Petersburg, and they didn't get penalized for it after Long Beach. Well, Dre, funny thing happened during Long Beach.
Yes. It said officials revealed that the 12 cars utilized the push-to-pass system with a compromised push-to-pass system that meant you were able to use it off the restart. Now, if Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe unless it's the final two laps of the race, you don't get push-to-pass until the second lap of a restart, right? Right.
Yes. Cool. So IndyCar rule 14.19.16, race starts and end of race restarts that occur before the lap prior to the white flag or prior to 3 minutes remaining at a time race event will have the push to pass system disabled and will be enabled for a given car once that car reaches the alternate start finish line, which for those of you that don't remember, on a road and street course is right before a pit exit or pit entrance.
Right. Here's the full statement. It says, quote, during lap 61's restart of today's IndyCar series race on the streets of Long Beach, IndyCar officiating discovered a push-to-pass software failure, which led to a post-race review. The failure left the push-to-pass system available to all drivers on the restart when it should have been disabled prior to passing the alternate start-finish line on lap 62. The push-to-pass system is governed by, as Chris mentioned, rule 14.19.16. The burden of the rule rests with IndyCar to assure that the software runs properly. In the review, IndyCar officiating learned that 12 cars utilized the system prior to the alternate start-finish line. IndyCar officiating does not view this as a team or driver infraction. Further analysis of post-race data showed that number cars received a position change as a result of the software error, with the exception of cars 66, that's Marcus Armstrong, passing car 14, that was Santino Ferrucci. Although this pass did occur, both cars utilized the push-to-pass system in nearly equal amounts on the lap. Based on this analysis, IndyCar officiating will not make any changes to the official results. IndyCar and IndyCar officiating will continue to evaluate the system failure and will implement additional protective measures to keep it from happening again at future events. Oh boy, it's happened again. And somewhere, you can't see it, but RJ O'Connell is about to lit a very fat cigar, because we all know that the main man...
I'm saying nothing right now. I'm just curious what you know, because you teased it up earlier that you got some extra intel to share. I'm saying nothing.
I do indeed. Obviously, a lot of people made the comparison to what happened in St. Petersburg in 2024 with Joseph Newgarden and Scott McLaughlin. They pushed their buttons and had an active push-to-pass system when they were not supposed to. Both men were disqualified from that race and deducted 10 points as a result of that. Both of us were disqualified from the race result in that one. Will Powell was also deemed to be in breach, but was only deducted 10 points as a result. Ironically, he only lost 2 in the end because he actually gained 2 spots from these 2 teammates at Penske being disqualified. So it was a net 2-point penalty, funnily enough. Now, I had a friend in the paddock reach out to me because I tweeted about this over the course of today's recording, and a lot of people drew ire with the term, I used the word cheating, and that ticked off a lot of people. Because that's what I do, apparently. I have a knack of just pissing people off on the internet when it comes to motorsport takes. I had a friend reach out of mine in the paddock and fill in a few of the missing blanks for me. This is not a one-off occasion. And this is why I think a lot of people have just kind of become okay with drivers pushing the button, even if they know it's not going to work under normal circumstances. From what I've been told, it is pretty common practice in IndyCar that people will push the button just in case the software doesn't work and they don't want to be left out on gaining a potential advantage in case there is an error. Because from what I've been told, this happens, and I quote, once or twice a year. We just don't know about it half the time, apparently. The only reason we got told about this one is because IndyCar's officiating board is now completely independent. And it's effectively a neutral third party, now being run by Scott Elkins, the former Formula E race director. Good to see him back in a major prominent role. Very, very good race director. Very good person to have in charge, if you ask me.
About sure. We're not even being sarcastic here. Like, no. And also, he's an American open wheel guy back before his Formula E days. He was Champ Car's tech director.
Yep. Very good guy to have in head. And I'm glad that at least the series has been fully transparent about this. But it hasn't been in years past, is what I've basically been told. So essentially, this is psychology. You push the button on a restart anyway, even when you're not supposed to, just in case it isn't working and you don't want to be the one left out when somebody else inevitably gains an advantage and tries to pass you. It links back to 2024 and the reactions to both Scott McLaughlin and Joseph Newgarden, how the original push-to-pass-gate scandal was handled. The general premise of what I was told was the reason why McLaughlin got off relatively light with the public is because he was sincere about what had happened. Said it was a 1.7-second, I think it was, button press. Didn't gain a real advantage in the end. And because other people in the paddock have done it and seen it happen, everybody just kind of took that statement as he was being sincere at face value. The problem was Newgarden had that awful press conference at Barber where he cried. He cited that the rules had changed when they hadn't. Only for thermal. But basically, because he fell on his sword for the team and essentially lied on their behalf, maybe milked it a little bit on the crying front. I don't know. You be the judge at home. That's why I think a lot of people gave New Garden shit in the panic, because everybody knew this was going on. It was just a very, you got caught with your pants down and now you're trying to lie about it, basically. That's why the reaction was how it was, from what I've been told.
McLaughlin put out an Instagram story the day the news broke 2 years ago where he said everything. It was just very upfront and said, hey, this is what happened. This is when it happened. And the main word is accountability. This is with what happened Monday morning. I guess it was Monday morning that this release came out. I forget. Time zones and all that kind of stuff. So the issue is the series at least came out and said that this was a bad on our end. Now, my question is, how is there not an automatic safeguard in place for this to take place? You look at Formula One, for example, back when DRS was a thing, once a safety car came out, it was outright disabled for the entire field until like the lap or two after the race went back to green. So how is there not an automatic system set up in place where the moment the race director says, full course yellow, pardon the word phrasing here, push the button for a full course yellow, that the system isn't automatically disabled in their system until, you know, the upcoming restart like that. Now, I'm assuming there's some IT person trying to log some code to try and figure this out. This isn't something that OpenAI can fix. Sorry, Chip Ganassi Racing. This is something that in my opinion, should have been a thing years ago. Like, it's an automatic process. This is disabled. Okay, we're going to have a safeguard in place that you can't. Sorry, my monitor just shut off here. Where you can't actually activate it until that time comes. So that's the question I think that really should be asked. And of course, with the Indy 500 Open Test coming up next week, there will be a few questions that are asked. And there will be questions asked of the drivers saying who actually pressed the button there. And of course, will they be telling the truth? I can't speak to that.
But that's the thing. We learned this back at Benghazi last year. We have a billion-dollar enterprise with $1,000 solutions for many of its most critical problems.
I was about to make that point off the back of what Chris had said. The reason why we don't have that system is because there is one, but it doesn't work properly. It's faulty, and it has been for years, from what I've been told, and they just haven't fixed it yet. That's the problem. Under normal circumstances, it works just fine, but allegedly, once or twice a year, it just will not work. And look, people took issue with me saying the C word in this instance in regards to it. It is cheating. And I need to make this point because you're not expecting that button to work when you push it, and it is a conscious decision. However, I will maintain all of this is solved as a problem if you just have a working push-to-pass system. Because if you did, you wouldn't have half the field pressing a button they know will not work on a restart, right?
I was told about 24 months ago that no other drivers would go reach for the push-to-pass button if they'd know it wasn't working. In all seriousness, you've had some form of push-to-pass in American open-wheel racing going back to the split years because Card introduced it first, Champ Car introduced it first in the mid-2000s. It is now 2026, and you still haven't figured out a way to get it to work as intended coming off a restart.
It's embarrassing. This is 20 years. I remember A1 Grand Prix had this tech. Like, and that was nearly 25 years ago.
Technology that is literally as old as Windows XP.
This is an easily solvable problem. And the worst part is, because of what happened in St. Petersburg in 2024, that should have been the warning to get this fixed once and for all, because it was a very nasty, very public falling out, which turned into a little bit of a character assassination for Joseph Newgarden, rightly or wrongly, over an issue that is not an isolated incident.
You can't hear it on the audio podcast, but I'm doing the Paul Dumbrell 2014 Bathurst 1000 face into the camera right now as I speak.
Yeah, and in hindsight, Now that we know, to be fair, I know a lot more about the situation behind the scenes, and again, that most of the public know, then if everybody knew that, then I suspect we wouldn't have been so harsh on Joseph in the first place, because a lot of this is just game theory in regards to a flawed system that naturally racing drivers, which will take any advantage they can get, are going to exploit this. Like, one problem solves the other in this instance. And I'm sorry, it's Bush League from IndyCar that they still have this problem. And it's Bush League that only 2 of 12 drivers are mentioned in a public statement about who pressed this button and who didn't. Because either you mention nobody or you mention everybody. Why did you only mention 2 of the drivers who did this? Oh, because it was an overtake on track? Like, naturally, if you're going to write the statement that way, people are going to immediately ask, who are the other 10?
Yeah. For all I know, Joseph Newgarden could have done it again, right? But who knows? Don't know who the other 10 people on this list are. Callum Ilott can say he didn't do it because he was stuck down the path of the illusion-free choice. You either finish last in IndyCar with Prima or you finish last in IMSA with Wright Motorsports and GTD.
That's all that's left.
It's just sloppy in every department, from a clumsily worded statement to the same technical problem befalling the series multiple times. You had a warning shot. You had your warning shot 2 years ago to fix this. And now this is the second time in 3 years this has happened, and people are more angry about the fact that I may or may not have called half the field cheaters over a technical problem that's the real issue. That, it's frustrating. It's like people are in a forest and they're looking for leaves when the trees are right in front of them. Like, it's like, we don't need to turn this into a game of personality assassination. We need to focus on putting pressure on the series to stop this embarrassing shit from happening. Right. Like,
because we're going to have the Indy Road Course coming up. It's the month of May. There's another opportunity for the push-pass system to either work as intended off of restarts or not work as intended off of restarts, and then you could find yourself back in the same situation as you were. Hopefully it doesn't happen again like that, but you never know. Again, billion-dollar enterprise, $1,000 solutions.
This is a $400 million racing series, according to how much Fox valued the third that it bought last year. If you're really worth that much, this is an easy fix.
Absolutely.
It's laughable that this keeps happening. Like, say what you will about other motorsport series, everybody's got their favorites, everybody's a hardcore for some series or another. I don't care where you choose to spend your time on motorsport, we don't need to be homers about this. Just fix the goddamn problem. Like, you know, it's a simple solution, and we never have to worry about this again. Like I said, if we had a working push-to-pass system, we wouldn't have half the field trying to exploit it. It's that simple. Because if they know it's not going to work, and they know it's, and then they know there's going to be no chance of a glitch happening, they wouldn't be doing it. It's that simple. They're doing it because they know it happens enough where there's a chance. It's that simple.
For sure.
The only thing Chris, I can say, speaking of, you know, all the software issues, I had a small little thing I had to work through here. So if I'm repeating something you already mentioned, my apologies on this. How did we find out originally that Team Penske had hacked into the push-to-pass system last year?
It was found out on the investigation because we didn't find out until 6 weeks after the race was over.
Because there was a software issue with push-to-pass the morning of the race in Long Beach during morning warm-up when it wasn't activated to the rest of the teams. Software glitches produce results.
Yeah, so then naturally when they investigate, they look back and they found that it wasn't working during St. Petersburg either. Yeah, there you go. So they had two in the first half of that season, and basically you'd have to go out of your way to find out that it didn't work at Long Beach, because that's not something that normally gets disclosed. Because let's be honest, even us as hardcores, not that many people watch IndyCar practice sessions. And like I said, it's a shame. The ratings have boomed. This race got 1.27 million viewers.
IndyCar is kind of mid.
For a race that was a classic Long Beach one in the pits fest. Like, IndyCar is 44% up on its viewers from last year as an average through five weekends. They're crushing it right now. This is the sort of shit that's going to make people stop watching.
It's amazing what happens when you don't go against the Masters and when you have NASCAR leading in your race broadcast.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Sometimes synergy like that, even with your domestic competition, can work to your benefit. Chris, any final thoughts on the Long Beach weekend before we start to wind things down?
I'm going to give a small plug for my Upon Further Review column, which I think it should be up on Front Stretch relatively soon here. It's easy to put in a lot of criticism towards certain drivers in the series for various reasons here and there. One of the biggest drivers that has been a source of criticism has been Nolan Siegel, and he had a crash on Saturday morning in practice and he qualified last. And if you look at the Arrow McLaren results graphics after every single race, you'll see Pato Award, you know, usually high up, except for Barber, Christian Lagarde, usually pretty high up. And then Nolan Siegel a lot further down. And there's all the comments of Nolan this, Nolan that. Nolan did an admirable job in Long Beach, and it's easy to heap criticism on him, but honestly, it's sometimes harder to say straight up, did good. I mean, yeah, did he? The only car he passed on track, he had two. He had Louis Foster late in the race when Foster's tires went off a cliff, and it got by Rinus VK on the last lap of the race. But considering where he's been all year, he did fine. He did fine, and that was good for him. Glad to see it, because he's needed that for a while, was the biggest mover of the race. Kyle Kirkwood finishing fourth, top five in every race this year, if my memory is correct. Graham Rahal finishing eighth. He's done well. He did well on Sunday. And then Mick Schumacher finishing 17th. He didn't run anything in first practice except for maybe one lap, and yeah, I think he had another issue. I think he had a crash in the second practice session in the fountain.
Yeah.
For him to actually finish 17th ahead of, you know, several drivers, of course, you know, Power had the pit stop issue with he hitting an AJ Foyt crew member who was fine, by the way. Good result for him. Good result for him. That's Rahal's all I have.
Rahal's top 10 in points right now. Like, it's he's having a really solid season so far. Worth pointing out. And yeah, it's a fair shout to say that, yeah, Nolan Siegel, who we've given a hard time on this show for many valid reasons, plus 13 on the day is never a bad day. And he needs more drives like that if he's going to keep his job. Unfortunately, he's got a very high expectation to be top 10 in points if he's expected to keep his job. Days like that might save your skin in the long run. And yeah, fair play to him on that one. For me, it's a shame in the sense that this was a race that was largely decided in the pits. You know, it's not the most ideal way of deciding an IndyCar race. I'm not a big fan of 27 cars being in pit lane at once. As we saw, again, glad that Kyle Collette's tire changer was okay in the end.
Yeah.
There was a very nasty running over there. Thankfully, everybody involved was okay. But yeah, this was a bit of a classic Long Beach in that there's always a risk that the race gets decided in the pits, and this was another one of those years. The whole podium drove incredibly well for me. Alex Palou was, as usual, fantastic. He's just so precise, so clinical. And if you give him any kind of opportunity, he will now punish you. There is no doubt about it. You've got to be perfect to beat him the way it is right now. And that's just how he is. Felix, best weekend in IndyCar for me he's ever had. That was a very impressive top-to-bottom weekend. Scott Dixon as well. Classic Scott Dixon. You know, you think he's nowhere, and that was, again, probably the most complete weekend an IndyCar has put together in quite some time to actually make the fast sixth in qualifying. It's something that Dixon just doesn't do very often anymore. And then, again, best pit crew in the business, gives him an opportunity, takes advantage, ends up on the podium. Vintage Scott Dixon, more than anything else there. And as mentioned from Chris as well, Kyle Kirkwood has not got off the top five so far this season. He is exactly what Ryan Eric King thought he was going to be when he made us sit down for a 75-minute special. This dude is great. He is disgustingly good. The consistency is coming and the floor is getting higher. It's amazing that in any other context, Kirkwood would probably have a 50-point lead right now already if it wasn't for Alex Pillow, because David Malukas is third in points right now, and he's 63 points behind already. It's these two, and then it's everybody else.
It ought to make things going into the month of May very, very interesting. Will the picture continue to look like that after the month of May? Because the road course is up next. The Grand Prix is up next.
Yeah, we got a half from now.
And Alex Pillow's won a lot there. Oh, no. He's going to do it again, isn't he?
Won the last three. Yeah. Arguably Pillow's greatest track, not named Laguna Seca. Have fun with that. Certainly will be their favorite going in. Just before we go, you've probably already seen the news as well over the weekend. A lot of extra eyes have been tuning into the Nordschleife at the Nürburgring racing series in preparation for the big 24-hour race coming up very, very soon. Sadly, there was a very tragic accident that took place over the weekend there, right before the carousel. Multi-car pileup, suspected oil on track, and unfortunately in that pileup, that crash claimed the life of Juha Mittinen. He's been a very, very good amateur racer. I mean, amateur in inverted commas more than anything else. He'd been racing there for over a decade as one of the really great gentleman drivers of that series. It's a very, very sad reminder that motorsport, as much as we love it, is unbelievably dangerous, and sometimes freak tragic accidents happen, and we lost a good one over the course of the weekend. And yeah, this one's for you, Jua, and very, very sad to see anyone on a racetrack not make it back to the pits.
100%. I know that there's been a lot of talk about how the incident was handled by our colleagues in the press. I will simply leave with some words from Daily Sports car photographer Jochen von Kalvenberge, who has been a longtime photographer of NLS events and knew Juha Mittinen for so many years. He knew him for 20 years. He said each one of them filled to the brim with him, enjoying driving the Nürburgring. He was one of those guys that never seemed to be able to get enough of the place and was always there with a smile. He was a kind, cultivated guy that loved the ring. He spoke more languages than you could count and always had a big smile on his face in the paddock. He was extremely passionate about Porsche and the Nürburgring, but he drove all kinds of Porsches there, from 964s to the latest RS models, and raced with his friend Dan at a stock BMW 325i. He always had maximum fun in whatever car he was driving. Juha Mittinen was 66 years young. Rest in peace, guy.
Man, my life well lived. Shame it was taken away a bit too soon. I say this as a member of the press. We don't have to mention Max Verstappen when these things happen. Seriously, we don't.
Yeah.
This does not need to be a race to the bottom for the almighty click. People's lives are at stake. And please, when these things happen, don't share the pictures. Just don't. Please. Please. Thanks for watching, everybody. Thanks for listening. I do really appreciate it. We'll be back next week for MotoGP Spanish Grand Prix at Jerez. Big, very important round coming up. Aprilia versus Ducati. Marc Marquez versus Marco Bezzecchi. Will Jorge Martin come into play as well? Fascinating round coming up as MotoGP hits Europe for the first time. Me, RJ, and hopefully Cam Buckley will be back to cover that then. places you can find us before we get out of here as well. YouTube.com/motorsport111 full episodes of the show. On YouTube, you can go to our Facebook account, facebook.com/motorsport101, and on Twitter at motorsport_101. If you'd like to follow us on Blue Sky when it occasionally decides to work, you can do so at Dre Harrison and at RJ O'Connell. Chris, you're at C_DeHardy. Is that correct on Twitter?
Just C DeHardy. Just C DeHardy.
There you go. Follow Chris on there. Tell him you said hi. We're on Instagram as well, Motorsport101Pod. We're on TikTok as well, with M101_podcast. They want even more thoughts on IndyCar and everything else that happens in motorsport. And now we're back to something like regularity for now. You can do so at motorsport101.com. Check out the blog section for anything written by yours truly, really. And if you really, really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our shows before they go out to the general public. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes live as they go going out, as Jason, as Edwin, and Vic did over the course of this show. Thank you very much for listening and watching, guys. Much appreciated. We'll be back next week for Haraf. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison. They've been Christopher DeHardy and RJ O'Connell. Thank you very much for watching and listening. Catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
Later, y'all.
See ya.